Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast, where we do unfiltered conversations and we recognize the hard work that it goes into to sharing our stories, sharing our experiences. And my name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I would like to give a viewer discretion as advice due to some of the topics that we'll be discussing. Again, viewer discretion is advised. Today, I am joined by one of the most beautiful souls on social media, but is also now a published author. Anna, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. I am so excited to see you, so excited to hear your story, and welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
And for those of you who do not know, Anna wrote a book. And Anna, you'll talk about this, but you may recognize Anna on social media from It's Afronomics. And Anna, walk us through your journey. Walk us through what led you to becoming a published author and what you're doing with it, because you're doing some very impactful work and incredible work. And this foreword was written by no other than Chelsea Clinton, which is incredible, incredible to see. Walk us through. Who is Anna?
One, you asked a lot of questions there, so I'm going to break it up as much as I can, but feel free to remind me of what questions I might have missed. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so grateful to be here, so grateful for the platform that you've helped create. It's helped, one, get the message out there, and two, really been a space of truth, which I think is important in our current culture of lies. So, it's great to have platforms that are really dedicated to telling people all the facts in ways that are digestible and accessible as well. So, where do I even begin? I think, I've now finished my US leg of the tour. For those who don't know, I was touring the US. I did seven states in, I guess, 4 weeks, which is when I really think about what just happened. It's quite nuts, actually, right? I don't know how I did it. My body is still intact. But I also feel very full from that experience because I think that it gave me sort of a front seat to a lot of different livelihoods and experiences that people are currently navigating, especially in our current political climate. A little bit about me. So, hi, everyone. My name is Anna. I'm super excited to hopefully be in community with y'all. I'm from Ghana and I've lived in Maryland for much of my life. So I'm a proud Marylander, go Ravens. And I really have a unique background when it comes to sort of thinking about how economic inequality has shaped my life and why I ask the kind of questions I ask today. So for those who don't know, I'm a Head Start kid. I love Head Start. I'm a huge, huge, huge advocate for the program. And for those who might not know what Head Start is, it's essentially a pre-K kindergarten program for, I would say actually pre-K preschool program rather for low-income working families. It's free for those families through funding from the government. And so, it's highly competitive to get in. I was able to get in when I was a child, and it really did set me up for success. I think it was kind of the first time I encountered educators, right? And educators who I believed really had a lot of faith in my ability to succeed and cultivated that. So, I was telling some folks on tour recently that I was oftentimes the line leader. I was called bossy a lot, right? Because I would be like, let's clean up, guys. It's nap time, guys. Like kind of a third or fourth teacher in the classroom, unsolicited, of course, because why are you telling me what to do? We're both 4 years old, right? So anyway, I really enjoy kind of that experience. And what people don't know is that, my entrance into, I would argue, quote unquote, elite spaces, and I don't really like calling them elite per se, but very selective schools happened at a very young age. So I was at Head Start, I was getting ready to graduate. And the story goes that, the county had some private school move in, and they wanted to build a private school. Namely, their elementary school portion of it. And the county required the school to admit one student from Head Start. This was an extensive interview process. There was about 20, 30 kids in my class. So we all had interviews and stuff like that. My parents were interviewed. and I was the kid that was selected. That meant that I got a full scholarship to this new private school. They paid for literally everything, my uniforms, any extracurriculars I did was covered by the scholarship. I didn't pay a dime when I was there. Really, my parents just had to drive me back and forth, provide me lunch, and even at that time, like, there were opportunities for lunch to be paid for as well. For those who don't know, I grew up in an affordable housing neighborhood. It was a sliding rent scale, so not everybody had like a whole lot of money. And my neighborhood was quite diverse. So I went from like at that time, being around black and brown students who had came from very similar socioeconomic backgrounds as me, to then now going to this private school where there's a whole lot of white students. I was the only black girl in my class, and the students were way better off, right? They all lived in single family homes, namely. They had minivans, right? Their parents had six-figure jobs. And so I kind of went through a bit of a culture economic shock in some ways, right? And especially when I started doing play dates, when I would go to people's houses and I would see they had like this sprawling backyard with all these playground items and stuff. And I come back home to mine, I didn't have a backyard. I had a slab of concrete with some dirt around it. My parents grew tomato plants to kind of like keep it fresh. We had one exercise bike, which was rusting. So just to give you a sense of like how I grew up. So I feel like those experiences at a very young age, and the kids just got richer as I got older. I ended up going to another private school afterwards on a very, very significant scholarship as well, pretty much full, really kind of put me in the front row of inequality, economic inequality. I saw it play out in my own life. And for me, I knew something was wrong, right? Like, why are my parents who are working four or five jobs or whatever not even making even a percentage of what my classmates' parents are making with one job, right? Like they're having to stack all these different experiences. I want to say here too that I was raised by custodians. My parents were part-time custodians for many, many years. They still kind of do that work sometimes. They're older now. But my respect for custodians, I don't like people don't, I get emotional when I talk about this. It runs so deep. Like the job is thankless and the people who do it are really trying to just make a living and make a life, especially for their families. And so if you know me personally, you know that I'm almost always going to be friends with the staff anywhere I go. So like I know all the HKS, sorry, the Harvard Kennedy School custodians, the staff that works in the cafeteria. I'm very, very kind to them because I believe that they're doing work that they themselves sometimes don't want to be doing, right? So anyway, that's all to say that like my parents have worked extremely hard and have tried their best to raise my siblings and I. And that's something that was in the back of my mind as I was navigating these spaces. Going back to sort of this topic around economic inequality, let me add some nuance to this, right? So I'm originally from Ghana, as I mentioned before, Ghanaian American. I was born here, sorry, born in Ghana for like 2 seconds. And then my parents migrated to the US because we got the visa lottery. The year I was born, right? So my life could have been very, very different had that not happened. And when I returned to Ghana for the first time at the age of 16, it became clear to me that the economic relativity that my parents and I experienced in the States was shifting. So in the States, we were closer to the bottom of the economic totem pole. In Ghana, we were closer to the middle, right? So I met relatives who were poorer than us, right? Who had less than us. I also met people who had more than us. But understanding, whoa, like we're in a different place economically, given the context that we're now in, was really jarring for me. And I felt like, well, I'm in a position of privilege now, right? And so I think that I can course correct this by, I think at the time I had visited a hospital in Bakwai, which is a suburb of Kumasi, which is one of the larger cities in Ghana. And I came back to my high school, which we had a community service project. And I said, I actually want to raise money for a computer for that hospital. Because when I had walked to the hospital, they were giving us a tour, all of their medical work records were on paper, which you can just imagine, right? Like if you were to go to your general hospital in your neighborhood and you saw stacks and stacks and stacks of paper, you're like, well, hold up. Like, are they actually like recording everything correctly? Like, like not even that, but like just tracking things is just gonna be so much harder. So I saw that need. I was like, you know, I'm in a position of privilege. I go to a private school where there's all these rich kids. There's people who want to give money. Like maybe we can do something. We were able to donate a computer to this hospital, and they're still using this computer to this day, which is such an amazing thing to hear about, which is amazing. Anyway, my point here is just that understanding where I fit in into the larger economic narrative has helped really anchor the way that I see the world and also how I want to change it. And so right now, what I do, for those who don't know, is, you know, I ended up going to college at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I majored in math, which is, I like numbers as a means to an end, namely, but eventually decided to get my PhD now in public policy and economics at Harvard Kennedy School. And really, the questions that I ask now are about race, gender, and the economy. And I would say gender along more of a binary angle, just because there's not a whole lot of data looking at other intersections. And I also feel like there are people who are better equipped to really get at the nuances of the LGBTQ plus community, but it's definitely part of the work that I cite, if that makes sense. And so with that in mind, the questions I ask really are about how do we disrupt inequality? And I would argue that the kind of work that I do, even on a public scale, is very much about that too, where I think part of disrupting inequality is actually making inequality known, right? Letting people know how unequal things are and giving people the same set of facts to operate off of, which is kind of where this book came from, which we'll talk about later. But I also think that it boils down to interventions and accountability. And so that's what my research does. Like, essentially, it addresses how do we hold workplaces better accountable to the discriminatory behavior that they display that is, by the way, illegal, right? Like, it's illegal to discriminate, period, especially in the workplace, but there's a lot of discrimination taking place. And so I am working with a number of different researchers on different projects to better hold companies accountable for that kind of illegal behavior that they'd be displaying. So that's essentially, in a very quick nutshell, who I am right now and how sort of my upbringing really shapes the kinds of questions I ask today and why I think talking about inequality and talking about economic inequality is really important.
It's deeply important because it recognizes the ongoing need for why we need to continue this advocacy and having the voices like yours, shattering those narratives that, hey, you know what? There is this double tax. This is what it is. This is why it exists. And it comes, even further into like the systems and how they were all created, right?
Right.
And I know back in 2018, you found or you co-founded the Sadie Collective. Are you willing to talk about that and what the Sadie Collective is
Absolutely.
and what led
Absolutely.
you to being a co-founder of that?
Yes. So the Sadie Collective is the first nonprofit organization in the country, and I may maybe in the world actually, to specifically address the underrepresentation of Black women and girls in economics and related fields. So think finance, think business, economics being really the main focus here, policy, that sort of thing. I co-founded that organization. Let me maybe tell the story. After a summer at UChicago Booth. So I was, you know, doing a research opportunity with a wonderful professor there, and we were in Chicago. I want to emphasize this, South Side Chicago. This is my first time in Chicago. Chicago, by the way, is one of my favorite cities in the world, probably number one city favorite here in the States. Just love the food is so good. The food is so good. And the skyline is gorgeous. Anyway, so was in Chicago, and at the time I was talking to my co-founder, Fonta, and she was at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, right? So these are the economists that oversee the economic system that oversees the economy, right? So they're the ones who set the interest rates. They're the ones who determine how much money is in circulation alongside this treasury. They do a lot of important stuff. And so both of those spaces are predominantly white. And right before I got this internship, and let me maybe add some more color here. The internship basically paid for the rest of my college tuition that year. That's how much they were paying me, right? So that's why I was there, right? So at this internship, it was super white. And I remember thinking to myself, like, yo, where are the Black people? We're in Chicago. And it wasn't until I stepped off campus that I was like, oh, they're here. This is just a very white institution. And it was similar experience for my co-founder Fanta, who was at Howard prior to the Fed. So she knew that DC was black, but the space that she was occupying was very, very white, right? 40 shades of beige. And so her and I were in a conversation, and we realized, like we had heard some statistics early on from black women economists about how the number of black women in economics is dwindling. It's declining over time. And so how do we sort of remedy that? And one way that we kind of came up with together was, what if we just bring all the black women who are currently in economics into one room? And let's just see what we come up with. Maybe we can come together, we can brainstorm, we can create programming, we can bring opportunities. And I want to maybe kind of level set here and tell people like how old I was when this was taking place, when we were co-founding the organization. I believe I was like 22, super young, right? I had not graduated college yet. It was my senior year when the organization became official. We had our first conference and it went viral. Anyway, my point there is we had to be scrappy. And I think a lot of times, I'm talking to people who care about activism and advocacy. I think a lot of times spaces online and beyond really are expecting people to kind of like hand them a playbook of how they solve problems in their community. And I'm just gonna be very honest and say that, like, there's no playbook coming your way, right? Like, there's no silver bullet solution coming your way. Oftentimes, you are the playbook, you are the solution. Me and, Fanta were like, yo, like, you just got out of college. I'm still in college. We happen to know a lot of young Black women who need this as a resource. Let's just come together and see what we can do. And we brought, again, I think we put a call out. Six Black women joined our team. This is the founding members of the Sadie Collective. And we all worked together to put on this conference for basically free. Like, we did not get paid. We asked people to donate. We didn't use that money for ourselves. We used that money to get people there, to make sure that it was heavily subsidized. That was something we did. And we did it off of Twitter. So we had done this whole campaign on Twitter. And like I said, people donated, I think it was about $14,000. Mathematica Policy Research lended their DC office as the first site for the conference. And 7 years later, I'm no longer in leadership and the organization is still standing. For me, I just got chills. That is legacy, right? Because we couldn't see ourselves in the space, namely for me, like I was Googling economists and seeing the same 10 old white guys. Went to the same three schools. It was kind of like, there's no way this is the representation of a profession that is so powerful. Like, economics is the language of power, y'all. People are listening to economists, whether they're on the left or the right or the center, right? And they're doing that globally to justify their policy decisions and to further provide credence for the kinds of ways in which they're enacting these policies into our communities. And so I kind of recognize that. But I realized that a lot of other people in my community would also recognize it too if it was presented as an option to them. And so I think, again, like for me, the fact that it's still living and breathing and still serving so many people, it's been crazy to be on tour and to run into people who say, you're the founder of the Sadie Collective. You really made a difference in my life. And I don't know them. I don't know them. I always tell people when I go to, conferences now or opportunities, and I meet young people who have been impacted by the Sadie Collective, it almost moves me to tears because I never expected to have such a lasting impact. And once you realize that that's the kind of impact that really makes a difference long term, like that's the kind of impact you want to generate every time you do something new. And so for me, the Sadie Collective is one of the greatest things I've ever brought to the earth. And it feels like an extension of my purpose and why I feel like I was born, quite frankly. If just one student decides, hey, I want to do this and I want to impact the world in this way because of that organization, I know that I did something meaningful. And so that's a little bit about the Sadie Collective and why it matters.
Whenever I think of a disruptor and a Silence Breaker, and I think of a role model, you pop in my head because you've inspired me so incredibly much. Just meeting you on social media, we've collaborated on a ton of posts, and I'm so grateful to have that opportunity to be around people that just deeply inspire me to keep going. Because there's been times that I've asked myself, why in the hell did I ever start doing this work, right? But then people like you come along on that journey. People like my co-founders, Gwen, Amelia, and Mercedes. People like my mom, that just keeps inspiring me. Damn, I'm getting emotional. Because I'll be celebrating being sober from fentanyl 10 years on December 27th.
Congratulations. That's amazing. I'm so proud of you.
I thank you. I appreciate you beyond belief. But it's people like you that just keep me going. And I was reading about the Sadie Collective, and I'm so inspired by just everything that you've done. You have quite the resume. That's all I'm going to say. And now you published a book, and I'm so incredibly excited to continue seeing. And I'm also going to purchase it and sit down and read it myself.
Love it.
And obviously, at some point, whenever your tours are done, I want you to sign it. And I know you'll be willing
First.
to do it. I already know.
Love it.
But let's jump, speaking of book, let's jump in and
Yes.
talk about your inspiration. You talked a little bit about your story. You talked about Sadie Collective. Now let's get into some present day things. You're about ready to finish up your book tour, or you already finished in the US, as you mentioned earlier. But now you're getting ready to head to other countries and share your story as well. Walk us through the inspiration behind writing the double text, and what you've experienced, while writing it, and what you're experiencing now, like the feedback that you're getting, because you have some incredible reviews on the book already, and it's not even a month old, right? Or is it a little over a month
Right,
now,
it's not
or?
even a month old. I think maybe it'll be a month in about 6 days.
Yes.
It's crazy. Let me maybe start by saying thank you so much again for providing a platform for this book too. You've been an instrumental person in that. So for those who don't know, the double tax basically is defined as the compounded cost of racism and sexism. And I wrote this book because of two reasons. I was tired of people lying. That was the first thing. People not telling the truth, right? Or making it seem like the truths that Black women especially were sharing with the world were invalid. That to me, I took that personally. And I said, you know what? Let me just put these truths in a book, cite the hell out of the book, right? Include all the sources that I can possibly include to make it unequivocally clear that we are not lying, right? Like this is absolutely the truth when it comes to what Black women and women in general experience. The book is also largely about the fact of the matter that it's expensive to be a woman in America and beyond. It's so expensive. And if you are identifying as a woman by extension, it's expensive for you too, right? And those costs just compound really when you think about trans status, disability status, racial status, class status, and if you are at the intersection of all those things, right? Religious minority, like it becomes more expensive. But for the sake of simplicity, and given what we know from the data, which is quite limited already, I really only cut across race and binary gender, and touch on class throughout the book. What inspired it, the second thing that inspired it was a conversation with a white guy, after a speech I gave. So I talked about this concept that I introduced the book with called Black Women Best by Janelle Jones, first Black woman chief economist of the Department of Labor. She's been featured in the New York Times. I highly encourage people to check out her work. It's gospel for me when it comes to policy making. And what she argues is that the best outcome for Black women is a better outcome for everyone else. Or put another way, when the economy is working for Black women, it's likely working for everybody else too. And this guy, heard me make that case. He didn't really buy it. He said, prove it. Prove that it would actually benefit society for Black women to be the benchmark for progress. And I said, give me like 3 years, right? Like give me a little bit of time. I will prove it. And this book is the proof, right? And what's crazy is I didn't think this book would, I didn't know what this book was going to be received as. I remember when I was writing it, which was sort of beginning of 2023 is when I started really writing it seriously. And in 2024 beginning was when I sort of wrapped it up. It was election year 2024, right? Last year. And I knew that depending on who won the election, this book would either be a prescription or a reaction. And what I've realized is it's actually both, right? I thought, you know, if Kamala won, it would be a prescription. They would use it as a kind of a policy guide. Whereas, you know, if the other guy won, this would be a reaction because they would be doing everything the opposite of what this book is suggesting in the solution section. What I realized though is that communities need solutions despite what's going on, right? Like probably in spite of rather, because like there needs to be a counterweight to all the madness and all the craziness that's taking place, that is usurping the lives of many people around the country and beyond. But I also recognize this is also a reaction because in many ways the administration is very dedicated to invalidating the experiences of the marginalized, especially Black women, by quite frankly erasing us, right? That's their attempt of removing people from leadership. But in addition to that, removing books from shelves, history from books, right? Like, so there's so many efforts to not document the inequalities that we know are true. And so this book is also evidence that, like, hey, sorry, this is me slapping the book. Hey, like, this is real. There's a lot of evidence to back it up. And despite your efforts to erase and ban and eradicate and eliminate, this book will stand the test of time. You can't get rid of this book. You can try to burn all the books that exist, they'll just print more books. So for me, I also am so grateful that this book will outlast me because it's an important book for women and folks who don't identify as women to be reading, right? I like to say real men read the double tax. That's what I've been saying on the tour. That if you're a man and you're not reading this book, I'm looking at you like you're crazy because you're trying to figure out why there's a male loneliness epidemic, which, by the way, I don't know if y'all know, the evidence suggests that men are not any more lonely than women, quite frankly, right? But to be honest, this conversation that's happening around young men and all of that is really rooted in empathy being absent from our society right now. And empathy, I would argue, towards women, right? Because a lot of times people don't want to have a conversation about how reliant society is on women, especially women of color, especially Black women, and how much unpaid labor, both emotional, physical, and financial, women are providing day to day, right? And so I thought to myself, provide the proof. If you don't believe the receipts that are already out there, I'm going to make it so easy for you to access those receipts so that you can't play in my face and say that you don't know what I'm talking about. And I'm realizing that I have a common theme with my scholarship, which is very much, I'm going to make it so obvious that if you claim ignorance, I'm going to call you on it right away. I like to say that when, you know, I hate people who are bigoted. Yeah, I don't like bigots. I'm not a fan of bigots, right? And if you want to be a bigot in your bathtub, that is your business, right? You want to bathe in those bubbles with your rubber ducky, that's your business. However, the moment you step outside, there I'm going to be holding you accountable with books, with information, with, you know, jokes that also educate people, right? Because I'm going to make it real hard for you to be a bigot with no level of accountability. That's not my MO. And so that's essentially why this book exists and what really inspired it as well. And I would say too, the fact that it's dedicated to my nieces is very intentional. I want young women especially to read this book.
Anna, you are taking me to church today because I am sitting here thinking like everything you are saying, it is soaking in. I am living, I'm breathing this journey alongside you. You know, as oh my God, there you make me so emotional in such a good way because just seeing the success. Seeing these, you know, reviews and seeing everything that you're doing, it is so deeply inspiring. And I know I'm just this little queer kid or queer 29-year-old that is here in Kansas, but I created a platform to amplify the voices that don't reach the headlines because mainstream media is complicit in silence. I mean, we see that. We see what's happening with the mainstream media. Look what's happening with CBS and, canceling the talk shows and like all of that, because freedom of speech doesn't apply anymore, as we see. But how do you remain positive in a society that continues to fail generations? And what is your message to anybody out there who's listening to this that may be feeling alone?
Well, let me say this, maybe a point of correction here. Freedom of speech has always been not available. It just has
Good point.
concentrated amongst certain groups. So I think
Very
what's
good point.
happened now, and this is kind of what the double tax illustrates, right? Those costs weren't addressed with Black women, women of color, queer women, right? And because those costs weren't addressed, that fire that was at house number five is now house number one, right? Now you're seeing rich white guys experience limits to their free speech. And that's very much because you didn't address what was happening with Jemele Hill or Amber Ruffin when it was taking place, right? So I just wanted to make that note. To your point about like finding hope during this time, I think I look to the next generation. I got an opportunity to visit a couple colleges on tour. I went to St. Kate's in Minnesota, and I went to Spelman College in Atlanta. And I think talking to these young women and just hearing their brilliance up close, I said, they're gonna be the ones to realize the promise, right? Like I'm a little bit older than them, but like, who knows what happens after this? But I know that they have a very clear vision of a better future. They know it's possible and they know who's in their way. And that's part of the reason why there's a lot of attacks on schools and books right now, because the people who are in their way know it too. Right? They know where their kids are at. They know how their kids are thinking. We're seeing this on how folks are talking about Palestine, right? This is not something that we weren't having this kind of conversation 5 years ago. I think even Jon Stewart made a little joke on Daily Show a while back about how he can never talk about Israel, even though he's Jewish, right? And so I think that like there's a very clear-eyed vision that young people have, and I consider myself amongst them at times too. And ultimately, it boils down to I believe that something better is possible. I believe that we can move towards something better. And knowing that they believe it means I have to believe it because they're further behind me. So if they can see it behind me and I'm closer, technically, right, to sort of what's happening currently and the future that maybe they're hoping to realize, it is my responsibility to make that path that they're about to walk on a lot easier to walk on. And so for me, I look at this book as sort of a guide for them, if anything. Here are some of the solutions you can start off with, but here's the context in which we're living in right now, right? You need to know this context because you won't know what to fight for and what to fight against if you don't know the context. And then once you know the context, here are some ways that we can start the conversation, how we can start moving things in your local neighborhood, at your school, at your city, at your state, and eventually in this country. But the focal point here, I think for me, is I am future-minded because the next generation is future-minded. And that's really the ethos of, I'm just thinking now, like everything that I've done. Everything that I've done. The first book that I published was called The Black Agenda. Brought together 35 Black experts, evergreen book, unfortunately, given that, racism has probably gotten slightly worse since the beginning of the year. But it gives a blueprint for why we should be paying attention to what Black experts are saying and why they really should be at the helm of a lot of these New York Times op-ed pieces, right? We should be giving them platforms to share their ideas and to share how we move through the rest of society. And as we're seeing with someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, There's a lot of knowledge that Black folks have because a lot of times we sit at the intersection, especially Black women. I like to say that, our society is a huge Venn diagram of many different experiences. And the persons who are dead center are Black women, which is why we have a better sense of what the long game is than probably any other group. I remember when the election was taking place, and I was hearing a lot of discourse around, should we elect Kamala Harris? Should we not? And hearing Black women being like, you guys don't get it, right? Like, you guys don't get it. There's a long game here. There's many futures that we can choose from. This is my friend Wawa recently. She was on Wawa Gaffer, who was on The Daily Show, saying there's many futures that we get to choose. And so ultimately, it boils down to what future do we want? And I take my cue from Black folks all the time. And there's one that I really want to shine a light on, Olufemi Tayo, who is a philosopher and a professor. And he likes to post on Blue Sky, here's how we're going to win. And he's right. This is a really, really terrible, horrific, stressful, devastating time. But we're going to win. We're going to get to the end of this. And the reason I know this is because the generation behind us is not standing for it. And at the end of the day, that is what they will need to sustain the madness. All the guys who are at the helm are old. They're trying to train their young men to potentially have the same thinking, but those men are outnumbered, right? This next generation is very much about making sure that our society and our world are more fair. And for that reason alone, I have to show up for them to make sure that they see that promise all the way through. Damn, that gave me chills.
You ain't the only one that gave me chills too. I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay. I'm like, damn, I could sit here and I can just listen to you speak for,
Oh, thank you.
hours and hours, but neither you or I have time for that. But, you bring such energy to everything. And I just gotta say something. I know I'm not the only one that's noticed this, but your laugh is absolutely contagious
Oh,
because.
thanks.
Every time I see a message request and it's a post from you, I'm like, oh, automatic accept,
Right,
automatic accept.
period.
If there was a way that I could go in and just do like the automatic accept, because
Listen,
I
I
do it
appreciate
almost, I
it.
do it almost instantaneously, because I'm like, oh, there's Anna, automatic accept. And I told, there's two other people that run the social media for Rise Above Justice Movement. I said, we get a lot of collaborations. I mean, we get like hundreds of requests of like collaborations, but I have your messages pinned. Like it's literally to the top of like our
That's
entire,
crazy.
because I love your content
Oh, thank you.
and I adore you. You know that. But, and I know that feeling is mutual, but we connected at a deeply important time. You've been a big sounding board for us, and we've been a big sounding board for you. And to continue amplifying that, you have an open invite for collaborations. You have an open invite to be on this podcast literally anytime you want to. You have an open invite. To anybody out there, be sure to follow Anna on social media
Thank
at
you.
It's Afronomics. And is there anything else that you want to say today, Anna, to empower people to recognize, organize, unite, and fight back?
The number one question I've been asked on tour is, what do we do next? And my answer has always been the same: unionize. I think unionizing and unions, people think about it through the narrow context of the workplace, which 100%, please join your local union. You'll get more money. It's going to protect you. Worker power is basically the future. That's what you want. I mean that broadly. There is no way we get through a crisis if not together. And I think there's people who are really trying to individual their way through this crisis. And I'm telling you, you cannot weather the storm that is here and that is coming. You have to link up with somebody else. You have to do something. Lots of people are like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Do something. Do one thing. Go outside. Volunteer. Mentor the kids in your neighborhood. Be a safe space for the elderly in your environment. Do something. Doing nothing is not advancing anything. I like to say that doomerism is not a strategy. You lamenting about how terrible the world is doesn't make the world better. It might make you feel better for a time that, oh, okay, I got this off my chest, but the world is still as bad as you left it. What will allow our society in this country to be better over time is a lot of people all over doing better things in their community. That's how we move forward. I think people are expecting a big silver bullet solution, a messiah of sorts, to come in and swoop and save the day. But I think it was Kendrick Lamar who said, I'm not your savior, right? Like, and the reality is, black women aren't your savior. Obama's not your savior. You know what I'm saying? Like, these individuals who people hail as, defenders of democracy are not your savior. You're your savior. Your community is your savior. You coming together with community will save you, right? And that's what I know to be true. And that is how communities have outlasted crises in this world, right? I come from the Akan culture. The Akan culture is many centuries old, right? We have so many cultures in the Chinese, China and Asian countries that have been there for thousands of years, and they've gone through all the ebbs and flows that this world has had to offer. They could not do it if they did not have community. And this is the time where the US is being tested. Will you survive the next 100, 200 years? Or will you allow a crisis to break you down to the bone? And what I know to be true and what we were talking about before is that I actually believe that people are more community-minded than they give themselves credit to. And so my hope is that anybody listening to this podcast, you will feel inspired to volunteer, join, participate in some community group nearby. It doesn't have to be, something big. It can be something small as your local soup kitchen during Thanksgiving, which is coming up in about a month or so. It can be as simple as you tutoring somebody who's nearby who might need it, or you providing services to your neighbors. I do think leaving your house is incredibly important. A lot of people have created those communities online, which can be helpful. But I think there's something about touching grass and smelling the fresh air that also inspires hope. And I hope that folks feel empowered to do that, especially after reading books like The Double Tax.
Absolutely feel like I just got a whole like lesson in everything in like 40 minutes, and I'm here for this. And these are the conversations that we need to be having, Anna. You know that just as well as I do, but we need to say it loud for the people that are in the back that are complicit in silence and not saying a damn thing. But that's not you. That's not me.
I
That's not
mean,
you. I appreciate you beyond belief, and I cannot thank you enough for coming on this podcast today. You've given me so much inspiration and so much hope, and I cannot wait to see what is next for you. I know you're going to continue being an advocate and being a leader and a speaker and a thriver, because you're organizing these communities to recognize the ongoing need to recognize the marginalized. So, thank you so much.
thank you.
I am your biggest fan. You already
Thank
know that.
you so much.
I don't need to tell you that. You already know that.
Likewise.
But thank you so much, Anna. And we will talk to you very soon, okay?
Yes, thank you. And say bye to your mom for me.
Absolutely. Thank you,
Thanks.
Anna.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.